about 224 and 226 dealing with forestry issues. So with that, I'll open a hearing on Senate Bill 224. And Harrison, can you tell us a little bit about this bill?
Mr. Chair, members, Senate Bill 224A growth ratifies the Northwest Wildland Fire Protection Agreement. This is a fire protection agreement apparently approved already by Congress and involving several territories in Canada and the states of Oregon, Idaho, Washington, Montana, and Alaska. It allows for fire protection across the border, sharing of resources for fire prevention, suppression, action. Apparently, all of the listed states and territories have already signed on to this treaty, as well as I mentioned, Congress has approved it, so Oregon can join upon approval of this bill.
So with that, as you can see, Senate Bill 224 is all new language, and with that, I guess, who's going to come up and tell us about this agreement? I don't have a sign-up sheet, but I don't really need one this morning.
Pretty soon, okay.
A lot of emphasis
in that, basically. None of us important. Mr. Chair, I'm Charlie Stone, Assistant State Forester for the Department of Forestry and head of the Protection Division. With me is Bob Young, the Acting Director of the Fire Protection Program. I hope that the small audience is a signal that there's no concern and no opposition to the bill. I think that is the case. As Harrison has pointed out, the Senate Bill 224 provides or allows the department to sign on to a compact with the listed states and provinces of Canada. It's a mutual aid type of agreement where you pay for what you borrow, and no one is committed to having to reduce their resources to provide somebody else. But if you can help out, then you provide that help when requested. The state or the province that receives the assistance or the training or whatever it is that is being shared between jurisdictions pays for the use of it. The receiving jurisdiction carries the direction of those forces and the liabilities locally, but the sending organization takes care of its own workers' comp and that type of thing. It's a traditional mutual aid type of agreement. This type of a compact has been in existence in the Northeast since 1952, the Maritime Provinces of Canada and the New England states.
Sorry, is this a compact, as we know, as compacts that states can make and then are ratified by Congress, or because it's an agreement with Canada, is that a little different than just what we know as compacts?
I believe it is. We've got, let's see, there's some examples. I thought we had some examples.
It talks about it being an agreement, but I think as members, we're some of us at least familiar with the issue of compacts, which basically allows states to go together and do things in agreement with each other, but those compacts then have to be ratified by Congress because the Constitution says that states can't join together and do different things unless it is approved by Congress.
Right, that is the case with this, and Congress approved this compact last October. The President signed it, I think, in December, and it's all been set up, and as Harrison mentioned, all the other states and provinces have already signed on, but because the Attorney General advised us that we also had to get the legislature's approval for the compact, then that's why we're here with Senate Bill 224. If we do get it approved, then we'll be able to sign on as well. And to that point, because things moved along considerably since the time that we began the drafting of this bill, we'd now like to ask if the committee would be willing to amend it to include an emergency clause, because we would then be able to take advantage of the compact during this fire season as opposed to going into effect probably October, September, or otherwise.
What brought this all about? Why are we just now doing this? We never had any agreement to work with Canada on these types of fires before, or what brought all this about?
Well, I'd say probably the fire seasons that we experienced in 1986 and 1987, which were pretty severe, and throughout the nation, the resources that are used for firefighting were pretty well capped out. It took some pretty intense negotiations and finagling to be able to bring some Canadian resources down to help us out in 1987. We didn't have any of these types of agreements in place, and since that time, because there's just a shrinking pool of resources overall in the country, we felt that something needed to be done to help supplement the available resources, and we've been working on it pretty much since that time.
Maybe you can talk a little bit to the Senate committee not familiar with forest land fires. How does it work here in the state as far as the State Department of Forestry, and are we talking about public lands, private lands? But can you tell a little bit about how you fight fires and how this whole thing works?
Certainly, Mr. Chair. In Oregon, each owner of forest land is legally responsible to provide protection for their forest land. The way that we do that is they can either they can choose to protect it themselves under a plan that they develop. They can band together in associations, or they can pay the state forester an assessment to provide that protection. Essentially, except for three active association districts in Coos, Douglas, and what we call the Walker Range Forest Protective Association in North Klamath County, the state forester provides that protection. We're talking about all private forest land. And in Western Oregon, we also protect the land owned by the BLM on a contract. And then the Forest Service protects the national forest. And so we have a lot of mutual aid agreements between the Forest Service and the department with rural fire departments who provide protection for the structures, whether on forest land or in the urban interface. And we provide the engines and the crews and the dozers and the aerial resources and that type of thing to fight the wildland fires. As I say, there's an assessment charge.
Those are called districts. Isn't there some fire districts out there that people actually the range area has some fire districts that people pay into, don't they?
Yes, there are both forest protection districts, and there are a handful of rangeland districts. One at Ironside over there in east and north of Burton's, and then there are three very newly formed rangeland districts down in Kearney County at Crane Prairie and down by Fields and that type of thing. And these are basically ranchers who have banded together to share their firefighting resources and work on each other's fires. They do that through an agreement with the Board of Forestry for oversight to make sure that they are organized with the different mechanisms, and it allows them, through mutual aid agreements, to tap into the resources that we have for firefighting. But the forest districts are pretty much set on county lines. For instance, the Western Oregon Forest Protection District is Lincoln, Benton, and Polk counties, and those are, you know, we have a forestry department office at Paloma. We have a district forester there that manages and sets up a protection for that, and we have 14 forest protection districts around the state. I'd like to talk to these four rangeland districts.
President Hill. Thank you, Mr. Chair. who are the actual members in terms of who is the representative from Oregon? But if this body were to get together and to propose amendments to this, who is that person?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, it would be a representative of the Department of Forestry, and we would tend to keep that open-ended, but it would likely be either myself or the Director of the Fire Protection Program.
Thank you.
Representative Law?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The Senate amended the original version in one section because we just a question, and that is, if it is amended, the governor invokes the article to withdraw until such time. It seems to me that you could set up a situation where this agreement and the working between the states would be very important, but if we withdraw for a period of time, that could kind of scum up the whole works, and so I was wondering what kind of discussion there was about this particular amendment.
Mr. Chair, Representative Erbelow, I believe that the amendment was put in there because of the concern that if the legislature has the authority and the responsibility to agree to this, it ought to also be able to agree to any changes. And there was concern that this compact in some way might obligate us to provide resources at a time when we're short here in Oregon. But that's not the case. We have the full ability to say yes or no to send resources, but I think it was a caution. The way that I think that particular section would work, well, on the one hand, it probably wouldn't pile up the compact considerably if we pulled out for a period of time. It just be that those resources weren't available to other folks, and we wouldn't have access to particular Canadian resources. We do have other agreements with these states in addition to this compact. Actually, I don't believe we have an agreement with Alaska currently, but and so it would be a little bit difficult for us. But I think the more practical way is that we would try to project if there were going to be changes, and work the timing out so that, in fact, we can get approval as close to the time that these discussions were completed and not have to actually pull out for a period of time.
Well, that's, Mr. Chair, that's another issue. In fact, as I thought, really, what does this amendment do? Because it just says until such time as the Assembly reviews the amendment. It doesn't say it has to approve it, vote on it. It just reviews it. So I assume that that wouldn't have to be the entire legislative assembly. It could be a committee. Was there a discussion about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Herbalow, I'm sorry to say I don't actually know. At the time, I've mentioned that Bob's the acting program director. At the time that this bill went through the Senate, the previous program director testified and participated in those discussions, and I was off dealing with other matters. So I wasn't there when they talked about that and don't know the answer to that.
The language is not very loose, to say the least.
Representative Byron, and
Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Currently, we have agreements with other states, and we send people back and forth. So what you're saying is that this is basically needed to use make an agreement with Canada?
That's the primary benefit to Oregon, given that we already have agreements with Idaho, Montana, California, and Washington.
Mr. Fowler?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I know that in the state, we have a statewide firefighting system, and in that statewide firefighting system, the employees, the resources in Western Oregon are normally net exported into Eastern Oregon in order to subsidize, so to speak, the firefighting there, because that's where the most intense and the worst fires normally occur. Very rarely do resources from Eastern Oregon come into Western Oregon or out of Southern Oregon into Northwest Oregon. Would this potentially make it so that Oregon would be a net exporter of firefighting resources, and that, in effect, would put a greater burden on the landowners in specifically Western Oregon who are paying their costs?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I don't believe so. One, we get very few calls. And as I said, we've already got these agreements with the states, and we haven't had that experience or concern. The fire season in Canada and in Alaska typically comes earlier than ours does. In fact, they're in fire season right now in most years. Their fire season occurs when things are dry and haven't greened up yet with the summertime as they're coming out of the winter. And so the opportunity exists to share resources at a time when they're not needed here early in the spring. And usually by the time their fire season ends, about the time that ours is starting to crank up, and we wouldn't would be able to have those resources back. But furthermore, if we viewed our situation as of concern and needing our resources here, we wouldn't send them out of state.
One more? Okay. Well, that statement itself concerns me because I can see this is an opportunity for the department to put on, because normally our firefighters don't start until late June, early July, and the department could use this compact as an opportunity to put on people sooner in the season with the anticipation they may have to get sent to Canada or Alaska, and if that never happens, then the landowners in the local area are going to be paying that bill for people we don't need in Oregon.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I understand the concern, and it is not our intention to put on additional firefighters to meet the compact. This is a matter of, for the very same reason, I doubt very much that the local associations would approve our budget to beef up to fight somebody else's fires, and that's not our intention. If the resources are available, they're already on, or those resources that are on, and if they're available, we send them, but typically a request of this site, we're not geared up in May and June, early June, to send a lot of engine crews or hand crews and that type of thing. We do have overhead who are our permanent employees that are always on duty that we could send to help manage a fire or to send training resources. For instance, this winter we got a request from the state of Alaska to provide some folks that could put on crew training or crew boss training for the state of Alaska, and ultimately we did not send them, but those are the types of requests that we feel we could meet with our existing resources.
Okay, Hill?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I noted the same words for you in the vein. I mean, I actually liked the fact that in terms of the compact, I think we have the potential of committing resources which we as legislative body are responsible for, that I would like the word ratify, versus abdicating our responsibility for this over to the executive branch, and we approve it once and we'll see you later down the road, and then there's no control. Because it's just well-meaning people getting together. I mean, there's that risk of what's the right thing to do, but it has a financial impact back on it. And that's my concern.
Mr. Chair? Okay, I was trying to figure out why they used review in one of the scenarios. That's why I asked if you remember in the session. But since we're only in session 6 months out of every 2 years, if we got out like at the end of June, the amendment was done in August, and the governor withdrew, and we didn't meet again, and if we all had to vote on it, there'd be this huge lag time. And so maybe that's why they used review, although I think it would be more precise to say as the Legislative Assembly or as designated committee reviewed, because we're not going to be here to review it, all of us. So I mean, it's very imprecise language, and that's kind of troublesome.
Talk about dollars a little bit. What does a guy like to represent by, or what does he pay for here, per acre, to protect his forest up in the Cascades here?
It ranges by district. Each district has its own assessment rate based on its fire experience and the credits back to the district of unspent money and that type of thing. But right now, I think the rates range from about 50 cents an acre up to about $1.05 an acre in the most expensive block of range association.
And we have some insurance. Don't we buy some insurance? Can you talk a bit about how we self-insure? We insure?
Yes, Mr. Chair. We are not self-insured, specifically speaking, but we have what we call the Oregon Forest Land Protection Fund, or the Emergency Fund. And landowners, in addition to their annual assessment rate for the active protection, pay either 4 cents or 6 cents an acre that goes to the emergency fund. Minimum lots, the smaller lots in the urban interface and all that, pay a surcharge to that of, I believe, $15, and then developed minimum lots pay a $38 surcharge per year. Those funds go into the emergency fund. The forest product harvest tax, which is assessed again for any harvesting in the state with a 25,000 board foot exemption, 50 cents per 1,000 board feet harvested goes into the emergency fund. So that creates an emergency firefighting fund that has a cap. It can go up to $15 million, and then if it reaches that cap, then the revenue source is shut off until such time as it drops back down. So that money is used when a district has a fire that goes beyond its resources and capabilities. Then additional resources that come in from other districts or from other states are paid for out of this emergency fund with a $25,000 a day per fire deductible. The districts are expected to be able to handle at least that much out of their own budgeted resources. Then with that emergency fund money, we also purchased an insurance policy from Lloyd's of London, which currently we pay about, I think the premium this year is $2.3 million. For a $43 million insurance policy with a $10 million deductible. So basically, the district's fire fires, the emergency fund can pick up that next $10 million or the first $10 million of additional resources if it's necessary. And then the insurance would kick in and provide up to $43 million in a given year. If we had a 1986 or 87 type fire season, which back then we spent $33 million worth of firefighting season we've had in 50 years or so, and with inflation and whatnot, that probably would rise up to close to $50 million today. Then, and we broke all those resources, and we probably have to come back to the emergency board and ask for additional general funds to pay the fire unit. But that's a pretty severe circumstance.
Okay, Colonel. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the $10 million deductible that you mentioned, is that an aggregate amount or is that a per occurrence amount?
That's the aggregate amount. Okay.
And then, Mayor?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You're close on the fire fund. That's $18, and $3 of that goes into the fire fund. And it's also not just improved small lots, but all improved lots pay the $38 surcharge. And that improved means a building on them. So basically, people with houses in the forest land are paying for firefighting protection, but not to the structure. The forest department does not cover structures.
Okay. I was going to take a look on my local cable about a house that burned down.
Mr. Chair, represented by the surcharge is based on the theory that even though we don't protect the structures, the firefighting amenities and the difficulty of fighting fire when you have houses intermingled with the forest make it a much more expensive proposition as well as a much riskier proposition. So there is a basis for that surcharge.
This current wildland, Harrison, in a staff nature summary, I guess when you did this, not Harrison, said the generic term referring to all unprotected forest lands. What do you mean by unprotected forest lands?
There are certainly lands within the state, Mr. Chair, that don't have any type of fire protection provided. Whether I would characterize them as forest lands, though, is a little bit problematic. I mean, the forest lands, as we view them, are incorporated into a district for the most part. Well, an example of an unprotected forest land in central Oregon, up around the Dalles and, you know, to the southeast of the Dalles, for instance. There's quite a bit of rangeland and open that has no rural fire protection, no forest.
This is talked about a Northwest Wildland Fire Protection Agreement. So what lands are we talking about here? I'm looking at the bill, line two, the Northwest Wildland Fire Protection Agreement.
Right, but in as far as unprotected lands.
So now, what are wildlands?
Oh, wildland, that's the term that's used nationally pretty much to signify either grazing or forest land. It's as opposed to urban land. It really, it's not wilderness.
Now, our stat major summary says wildland is a generic term referring to all unprotected forest land.
Oh, that's not correct.
That's the reason I'm questioning that.
Yeah. No, wildland is any non-urban land, whether it's protected or not protected.
Protected would mean it's within some type of a district or covered under fire protection.
Yes.
I was questioning that statement there.
I'm sorry,
I think that's a major summary here.
Mr. Chair, a follow-up question. Do the other states provide the same level of coverage insurance for themselves to this compact that we currently have, the agreements we currently have, plus what this would do, which is kind of a reauthorize what we already do, but do the other states provide the same level? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Representative Byron, no. Oregon is unique in the nation as far as having this type of an insurance policy. Each of the states has their own financing schemes, and I'm not intimately familiar with any of them, but for instance, the state of California provides its firefighting almost exclusively from the general fund, I believe, and their budget is several times larger than ours. They protect structures, for instance, in some counties, and that thing. But each of the states is different. As far as the ability to be sure that we're going to get our money back, if that's the concern, it's a matter of the agreement that the receiving states shall pay for the resources, but they may not always have the same backup that we do in terms of the insurance policy.
Well, what is the guarantee that will be paid? I guess that would come down to the bottom line.
Well, I believe the guarantee is that they have entered into this compact and say that they will pay and that they can be held responsible for that, I believe.
But in Oregon, okay, maybe it's true.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
In Oregon, if we have fires that go over the $43 million level, there's no guarantee that general fund or anything else is going to cover. That money comes out of my pocket as a forest landowner. So if, in fact, we get into... You know, I'm concerned about that issue that, you know, when we get into some big fires, I'm going to be stuck with $5 an acre charge or something like that to pay the California firefighters.
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, if we fight the fire, short of giving up and letting it burn, if we fight the fire, yeah, the cost has to be met back ultimately by the landowner if we've exhausted all the other resources. But that's really a question of whether we fight the fire or not who comes in to help us and provide those resources. If we make the decision to try to stop it and use the resources, then we have to pay for them.
Okay, with that, this amendment, do we need to get that drafted by LCE, or are we going to want to do this conceptually, or I think
Mr. Chair, I did not have an opportunity to request that from council, but an emergency clause is certainly standard language.
Mr. Chair, I may just add that Terry Rammers was here earlier from the Small Woodlands Association and authorized me to say that they have an organization in strong support, and I believe so are the industrial landowners.
Would you like to identify yourself and your partner here with Rachel Charlie? He's saying they're about to go to sleep here. Oh.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Young. I'm the acting program director. And I'm just with Charlie here to support him in the session.
He has more background knowledge in fire than I do, and I thought that I may need him, sir.
Well, I didn't recognize you this morning, Charlie, but when you said your name, I said, yeah, I know that guy. You've been around here a while working on these issues. Yes, sir.
Okay, Hill. Mr. Chair, I was just beyond the emergency clause in terms of language, basic section 4.
We have some suggestions. Yeah, you have some suggestions on that. That word review is still bothering some members here. What are your suggestions?
My suggestion is that the special time legislative assembly ratifies Amendment 4. The emergency board reviews the amendment and recommends continued participation for such time as the legislative assembly meets in regular session. That way, the e-board can review it and say, continue to participate, or if it is such, it would have a material effect, they could recommend not participating in it, and then they'd have to come back through the regular session. So it would vest the authority in the e-board.
Mm-hmm.
When the legislative assembly is not in session to recommend continued participation on the amendment.
That sounds all right. That's for us committees. So we have a little bit of a say on this thing. How's that sound, Rachel? You're the drafter.
No, I think as it stands out, really is unclear what it means, and that would certainly clarify it. My only concern, I would like to try to respond, is would the legislature become micromanagers of, you know, how we're dealing with forest fires? I don't think so, but you would have a better...
This is called the sort of standard language.
Mr. Chair, I might just add that Terry Lammers was here earlier from the Small Women's Association and authorized me to say that they're an organization in strong support, and I believe so are the industrial landowners.
Would you like to identify yourself and your partner here with us? I'm sorry. He's sitting there about to go to sleep here.
Mr. Chair, I'm Bob Young. I'm the Acting Program Director. And I'm just with Charlie here to support him in any questions on that.
He has more background knowledge in fire than I do, and I thought that they need him. Sir.
Well, I didn't recognize you this morning, Charlie, but when he said your name, I said, yeah, I know that guy. He's been around here a while working on these issues.
There's a hill. I was just beyond the emergency clause in terms of this language.
They have
some suggestions.
Yeah, you have some suggestions on that word review is still bothering some members here. What are your suggestions?
My suggestion is that such time as words are sending ratified amendment or the emergency board reviews the amendment and recommends the participation for such time as the legislative assembly meets in regular session. That way the e-board can review it, say, continue to participate, or if it's such, it would have a material effect. They could recommend not participating in it, and then they'd have to come back to the regular session. So it would vest the authority in the e-board when the legislative assembly is not in session to recommend continued participation on the amendment.
That sounds all right. That's for our committee, so we have a little bit of a stamp on this thing. How's that sound, Ms. Vanderbilt? You're the drafter.
No, I think as it stands out, really is unclear what it means, and that was certainly clarified. My only concern, I would like Charlie's response, is would the legislature become micromanagers of, you know, how we're dealing with forest fires? I don't think so, but you would have a better read on that than I would, being this is your business.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verbalow, I guess from where I sit, I believe that we can make responsible decisions about the amendments of the compact and protect the landowner's interests and that type of thing. judging as to whether it's micromanaging or not, I suppose it did raise some concern with me to have to cancel the agreement, go back and get it ratified. But I think Representative Hill's suggestion is certainly clearer and better than where we are here. And I recognize the legislature's authority and their responsibility to ratify, so we don't have any concerns from that standpoint.
Let me ask a question. We do this all the time, and we say to different boards and so forth, you can raise your fees and when the legislature's not in session, and then come back and we ratify it after the fact. I'm wondering what you think of that concept, that the Forest Service, in a sense, informally ratifies it, but then brings it back to us to say, yeah, that was okay, just move forward. Would that simplify the procedure?
Well, I guess my concern is the fact that, you know, this is an international agreement, requires congressional approval, it's compact among states, in terms of, and just by saying, you can adopt any amendments you want, you know, if it takes the legislative assembly requirement to ratify it, one could conceivably extend that responsibility and authority to any amendments thereof. To me, this would say there's a review process. You can recommend that you continue participation until such time as we're back in regular session. Then it's going to need to be in a bill where we ratify the changes. So this will be codified and not be any statute.
Well, I agree we need to ratify it, but I was just wondering, instead of bringing it to the e-board, if we could just let the department make a judgment on it and then bring it like we do with fee increases.
But I think in terms of this, in terms of I don't know if they're set up in terms of for any public hearing process on this particular thing, in terms of where the fee process is, the boards are representatives of those who actually pay, of the organization who would be paying the fees, and so they're responsive to their own membership, and here we're talking about basically imposing fees that could be substantial on landowners that don't necessarily have representation on the board. Is that a correct statement? I don't know if you have a firefighting board. I don't know the structure.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, two parts to that. There are association boards who approve and review and approve the budgets for those districts. But this agreement really doesn't change anything in terms of the overall cost. Again, it's where we go to get the resources. If we had a going fire and we couldn't, say, go to Canada, well, we may not be able to get the resources, but we might, in fact, then, instead of getting resources from the state of Florida, the state of North Carolina, or whatever, through the national system, still going to have those charges, and that's something we already manage. This doesn't really change that structure. If I might, Mr. Chair, point out, I don't know if this is helpful or not, but I'm not sure how this is possible, but within the agreement itself, page 3, line 45, Congress has ratified this, and it allows that amendments to this agreement can be made by simple majority vote of the members, and will take effect immediately upon passage, so that the agreement itself appears to be able to change within the authority that's been granted by Congress. It's only at this point through the A and Growth that the Oregon legislature said, no, you've got to come back to us and get it approved again.
Mr. Chair, sure. But I'd also note that Congress isn't paying any of the money.
Sure.
So it's easy for them to say, go make any changes you guys want to do amongst yourselves. Their responsibility is in terms of this, they're taking it to a foreign country. To that extent, they're saying, yeah, you can go do that with the provinces of Canada. And so it's a different issue. But I think that you would find a different approach if we were spending their money. That they would want to have a say in it. So
I'm sure you're right.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Barr.
Thank you. I think Representative Hill's got the right direction here, that we have to have legislative oversight, because we, in fact, do have to pay the bill. But I recognize he has some language there he suggested, but at the same time, I feel uncomfortable doing that language conceptually. I would like to see that language there. I have Harrison take it back to legislative council, make sure we've got the I's dotted and T's crossed, but I do like your
future constitutional as
well. Oh, that's a idea.
Hearing on Senate Bill 224 and open a work session. And with that, let's have a motion to conceptually amend this, and then we will send that. Not conceptually, let's have a motion of a. How do we want to do
this? I'm going
to
share the piece of direction, Harrison.
Sure, I think I can just make that request.
Yeah, we'll have a request, and we'll bring it back in LC4.
And we have two amendments, and the emergency clause and
Members, may I add, just for clarification, some of what Representative Hill was suggesting is that there should be ratification rather than review and review it during the interim, review and a positive recommendation from the e-board for continuation.
Okay, sorry to interrupt. All right, is there any other discussion on this, Ms. Hill?
Mr. Chair, my only question is with regards to a fiscal impact. There doesn't seem to be a report in the file. Is there no fiscal impact?
Mr. Chair, Representative Crummell, I did just review that again, and it is no revenue impact, no fiscal impact on the pay and growth.
Thank you.
All right. If there isn't any other discussion, I think we're pretty well. Learned a little more about how you do your firefighting, Charlie. Big issue, a big area. We will see. I don't know any other bills coming through this session. Normally, you have a few bills.
We have another one today.
Right, yeah. That's not very many for this issue. Only a couple, all I see. So that closes the workshop on House Bill 224 and open it. We're hearing on Senate Bill 226. Harrison. What does this bill do? Well, we get some paperwork here.
Mr. Chair, Member, Senate Bill 226 clarifies authority and procedures of the State Forestry Department related to forest fire prevention and protection. I think specifically this relates to fire protection on Zone 1 lands, which are forest and range lands, I believe, that are mixed within grazing and agricultural lands. There's a lot of housekeeping here. There are only a couple of places where there are at least arguably substantive changes. I believe perhaps affected landowners may have a slightly broader opportunity for requesting hearings. The department probably has a little bit better opportunity to go after people who willfully or negligently start fires than to go after them for cause. But for the most part, there are just language changes here that update statute.
Thank you. All right, we have a handout from Charlie here. Okay, welcome back here on Senate Bill 226. We can talk some more about forest fire prevention. This does talk about Zone 1. Is that the correct definition, Mr. Harrison?
Mr. Chair, for the record again, Charlie Stone of the Department of Forest. Actually, only Section 1 of the bill deals with Zone 1 land. Zone 1 lands are, and that Section 1 deals with Chapter 476 of the law, which is the fire marshal statute. Zone 1 lands are lands that lie outside of the forest protection district, but which, and in Oregon, the only place that the Forestry Department protects Zone 1 lands is in the Central Oregon district in the John Day area. And these are lands that the county requests the forestry department to come in and provide protection on the same basis as we do for forestry land. And so there's currently zone one lands in Grant County and maybe Wheeler County pay 25 cents an acre to the state forester to provide protection of those primarily grazing lands. The rest of the bill deals with Chapter 477, which is a forest fire fighting statute. And as Harrison points out, primarily these are housekeeping, but not entirely. Basically, for the last two sessions, and this one, we've been on a process of trying to update and streamline Chapter 477, going through the whole chapter, bringing things up to date, making adjustments here and there. We've got a couple statutes that are proposed for repeal. In one case, one of those statutes provides for owners to appeal the budgeting processes, but we've incorporated that same concept in another part of the bill, I believe in Section 6. So we haven't taken away anybody's opportunities to appeal to the Board of Forestry. In fact, through this bill, we've provided a broader opportunity. It used to be that you had to be at the board's meeting in June to raise a budget appeal. This allows off-site or different timing for hearings and that type of thing on the budget process. Without going into detail on each individual item, I'd be happy to answer questions. It is, as Harrison says, an attempt to clean up the statutes. I think there was a reference to better able to collect costs, and in particular that refers to Section 4 of the bill. This allows in those areas where there is land outside the Forest Protection District, and let me contrast things. For instance, in our Southwest Oregon District, which is Jackson and Josephine counties, the entire area of both counties is within the Protection District, so there is no area outside the protection. But you get over into Central Oregon, where there's a lot of open land, ranch land, grazing land, that sort of thing. Those areas often are unprotected, and so the Forestry Department's authority is within a protection district or on or within an eighth of a mile of that protection district. And the idea is that we're trying to protect against those fires that may spread onto the district. In this instance, it allows us to collect the cost of a fire that's willfully or negligently set. If we go out to meet that fire, it's rapidly moving towards the protection district beyond an eighth of a mile. It's not our habit to go 2-5 miles out beyond the district, but if there's a road that makes a good fire line, good place to stop the fire at a half a mile from the boundary, and that fire's running before the wind, then it makes sense for us to go out there and use that as a firefighting tactic. And this would allow us to still collect the suppression costs in the case where that fire is willfully or negligently set.
Sorry, in Section 3, there, line 22, with alternate fire prevention suppression strategies. So this is an example where you can keep it under control and maybe use some let it burn and go ahead and lower the fire load. Or what are we talking about in alternate techniques?
Mr. Chair, the Department of Forestry frequently uses bulldozers to build fire line. It's the most rapid and effective way to get a good fire line and stop, and yet there are areas where a light touch on the land is desired. We have some landowners, for instance, the Nature Conservancy, who own property primarily to preserve those unique characteristics and whatnot, who may request that if at all possible that we not use bulldozers or that we not use retardants or some other firefighting tactic. And this kind of memorializes that concept, recognizes that if a landowner wants to request a different firefighting tactic, that we can recognize that, and where it's appropriate, we'll honor those requests, and when we can still, prevent the damage to adjoining landowners or the forest resources. But it also preserves the forest's judgment and the ability to use those more efficient, if you will, tactics where they're necessary. So that's the typical type of situation that this was built to recognize. If someone, and it happens all the time when we fight fire jointly with the Forest Service or the BLM, they have different resource areas, protection and that, where we're not allowed to use certain tactics.
Well, where does some of the new philosophies come in concerning let it burn, lower the fuel load, and that sort of thing? How are you working in some of those concepts? Are we just putting every fire out to start?
Mr. Chair, on the lands protected by the Forestry Department, it's the latter. When the fire starts, and it's not a planned fire, it's not a prescribed fire, our strategy is to suppress that fire as quickly and as efficiently as possible. The Forest Service, the BLM, the other federal agencies have a federal fire policy that allows them to make decisions when they have a plan developed. that in certain areas, in wilderness areas, in areas where they, they'd like to reduce the natural fuel loading, they can make a decision to let that fire burn for a period of time, watch it if they think it can be managed and kept from escaping their ability to control it. At some point, they'll let it burn and accomplish those benefits that sometimes accrue from fire. But because we're primarily in the business of protecting the forest resources that are owned by private landowners, our strategy is to suppress every fire as quickly and efficiently as possible. So we do in employ prescribed burning at a time of year and under a prescription where we light those fires and try to reduce fuels and then keep them contained. But at a time when a fire starts on its own and there is no prescription in place, no control mechanisms in place, we immediately move to suppress the fire.
Okay, Byron.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, in that subsection 3, if a landowner requests no bulldozers, for instance, and the state forester says, okay, in this case we won't use any bulldozers, then that fire escapes, burns onto my property. Who's now liable for that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beyer, I'm not sure that I have the legal answer to that. I think the origin, as fire liability occurs right now, there's, if the fire was set negligently or willfully, or someone failed to meet their obligations to suppress the fire, they may become liable. In terms of the suppression cost, it burns out of your land. Of course, the system will pay for that, but it comes back on your assessment. And you're talking about damages now.
Yeah, I guess
I don't have a clean answer to that. Certainly, there a court or a jury could find the Department of Forestry negligent in making that decision. My hope is that if there were any real risk at all of that happening, that we would not choose to not use the most efficient tactic.
Follow up on that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I guess that's the key. Let's say the fire is a lightning strike fire, because obviously if it's a logging fire, the logger is liable for up to $300,000. But if it's a lightning strike fire and the forest department arbitrarily chooses because this landowner doesn't want a bulldozer to use, where then in the court of law, I as an adjoining landowner have, a couple $100,000 of timber burned up because of the fire, that the forest department could have stopped by using a cap. It seems to me like you're putting the Department of Forestry directly in the line to be liable, and then when the costs come back against me as a landowner who was filing suit because I have to pay the suppression costs to require the forest department was liable to let go.
Mr. Chair, for my own purposes, I think they we're mixing the liability for the suppression costs and liability for damages to your timber values. As far as the suppression costs, except as your share of the assessment, those would certainly be paid through shared by all the landowners if there wasn't somebody to go back on for the origin of the fire. As far as your ability to collect damages, I think there's potentially always the possibility that someone feels the Department of Forestry has not carried out their duties responsibly, that there can be an action brought against the department. Our folks are pretty squared away in terms of fire behavior and fire control techniques. I don't see us making a decision to honor a request of a landowner to use some lesser tactic if there's any the conditions are such that we're worried at all about it spreading beyond that landowner's property. Yes, it could happen, and I suppose that the mechanism would be to sue the department for making a poor decision, and whether or not you'd be successful, I wouldn't have it again.
Okay,
moving
on.
Well, I was just going to say, thank you, Mr. Chair, that we'll never know the standard of until coming out of the Brian Court, but it would be the same standard as right now that you're held to when you fight a fire, that you use correct procedures and you're not negligent. And this is just part of that, how you would fight a fire, because the ultimate decision-making is yours. You decide if that would be a feasible way to go and a safe way to go, or you decide it's not. So it's just a part of the whole mix of how you fight the fire, and I don't see it as any different than what they do in a normal course.
Mr. Chair, if I might, I agree with what Representative Erbelow said, and I think really the point of this amendment to the statute, revision to the statute, is to make it clear that the forester still has, even though a landowner may request certain tactics, that the forester still has the judgment to apply what's the most appropriate to provide protection to everyone. So I think that's really the point here and the way that we would manage that.
President Hill? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I had read that same section and had been concerned with Senator Beyer in terms of, well, it's really great if you want to burn your house down, go ahead and burn your house down. But if you want to do that, just don't burn my house down in the process of it. And I think in terms of, you have that thing, I think there should be a follow-on sentence that says
the responsibility of the force is the way that with whether that increases the risk of contiguous land, or, you know, the responsibility to contain it. If the landowner wants all of their trees to burn down, that's great. Just don't burn down the neighbors. That's my only concern in terms of it. I think that can be solved by an additional sentence there. It just puts the responsibility back that you can weigh that and you can do what the landowner wants to do, not if it increases the risk of spreading the fire from a contiguous land. It's not owned by that landowner. In addition, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm curious as to on page 2, line 11, in terms of what was the impetus for defining what the word clearing means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, to the second question first, as I asked about that, and Harrison called yesterday and asked some questions about that, I believe that the impetus was simply that the term clearing is used in many places throughout the Chapter 477 and has not previously been defined. I think there is a concern on no particular episode that has brought it forward so far that a person reading that might believe that it only refers to an active operation or clearing made by some person, or that it only refers to a natural meadow or opening or grassland, when in fact it is the intention of the statute that it applies to the entire universe of those possibilities, including roads, rights of way. And if it's even though an area may be cleared of most of the debris, but it's integral to an overall portion of forest land, it is forest land, and that's the real intention of the statute. If I might go back to the first question, or maybe it was a comment more than a question, but in terms of adding additional language to ensure that the forester makes those judgments, if you look just above the new language in subsection 3 on lines 20 and 21, the already existing in the statute is the idea that if a fire is burning uncontrolled or is threatening, that the state forester shall summarily abate the nuisance by controlling and extinguishing the fire. So I think that it already sets the tone that that's our job out there. And then 3 says that, you know, we can take these other requests into consideration when in the judgment of the forester conditions warrant, but the controlling still is that we're going to abate the nuisance.
I think there's adequate language there, but
Chapter 477, is that relating only to fire suppression?
Yeah, it's Chapter 477 deals with forest fires. It deals with the setting up of the protection districts, the assessment procedures, the cost collection capability, equipment requirements, that anybody, but it's all focused on forest fires, yes.
So I guess I'm just trying to understand in terms of you and the rulemaking authority would be able to define what clearing means. I'm just curious why the request to put it into statute, because it wasn't previously defined, and does it have a material effect in terms of assessment? So I'm just curious. Is this just like a sore thumb today, why we're defining a single word?
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, there are places in the statute where the word clearing is used, and it never has been defined, so we decided to add that as a definition. And the legislative council through inside the forest land definition, otherwise it would have been a standalone.
If I might add, I think that when, you know, in any, in so much of the Chapter 477, when things are contested, it's either because someone doesn't feel that their land should be paying protection assessment, or because we're trying to collect costs after a fire. And when you're dealing with the litigation on cost collection, I don't know that this is true, but I think we probably have a stronger standing, a firmer standing when those definitions are in statute as opposed to the Board of Forestry's rule. And as Bob said, that does control some of those types of cases. We find it better to put it in the statute.
Can we move into work session?
Yeah, let's close the hearing on 10.226 and open a work session. Does anybody belong?
Yeah, this thing just moved 10.226. To the floor with the two tenants' recommendations.
We have a motion to move the bill to the floor. Any discussion on the motion?
I don't care about this. I'm a little uncomfortable in terms of without the additional sentence on section 3.
Mr. Chair. I would be uncomfortable with the additional chair just because of how the law is applied in general. Because I think that would confuse it. It's very clear here that the ultimate authority falls on the department. And as part of that authority, and I'm thinking from the point of view of the law, is in their decision-making, they have to take into consideration the risk to the adjoining property and whatever, and that's what the court would find. And that's so clear in the law. I think adding another sentence may confuse the issue.
I really don't think we have enough of an issue here myself to warrant an amendment and additional paperwork on this bill.
Mr. Chair, adding Section 3 to Section 3 does give me some concern because I think clearly now it says that the Forestry Department shall suppress.
It's Chapter 477, does that remain only to fire suppression?
Yeah, it's Chapter 477 deals with forest fires. It deals with the setting up of the protection districts, the assessment procedures, the cost collection capability, the equipment requirements. That's anybody. It's all focused on forest fire, yes.
So I guess I'm just trying to understand in terms of you and the rulemaking authority would be able to define what clearing means. I'm just curious why the request to put it into statute. It wasn't previously defined, does it have a material effect in terms of assessment? So I'm just curious. It's for something, so we're defining a single word.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hill, there are places in the statute where the word clearing is used, and it never has been defined, so we decided to add that as a definition, and then legislative council put it inside of the forest land definition, otherwise it would have been a standalone.
If I might add, I think in so much of the Chapter 477, when things are contested, it's either because someone doesn't feel that their land should be paying protection assessment or because we're trying to collect costs after a fire. And when you're dealing with the litigation on cost collection, I don't know that this is true, but I think we probably have a stronger standing, a firmer standing, when those definitions are in statute as opposed to the Board of Forestry's rule. And I think, as Bob said, that does control some of those types of cases, and we find it better to put it in the statute.
Yeah, that's the hearing on Senate Bill 226, open a work session. President LeBlanc?
Yeah, this thing, this moves Senate Bill 226 to the floor with the two pass recommendation.
We have a motion to move the bill to the floor. Any discussion on the motion?
I'm a little uncomfortable in terms of without the additional sentence on Section 3.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair?
President Verbalon.
I would be uncomfortable with the additional chair just because of how the law is applied in general. Because I think that would confuse it. It's very clear here that the ultimate authority falls on the department. And as part of that authority, and I'm thinking it from the point of view of the law, is in their decision-making, they have to take into consideration the risk to the adjoining property and whatever, and that's what the court would find. And that's so clear in the law, I think adding another sentence may confuse the issue.
I really don't think we have enough of an issue here myself to warrant an amendment and additional paperwork on this bill.
Mr. Chair, adding Section 3 to Section 3 does give me some concern. Because I think clearly now it says that the Forestry Department shall suppress fires in the best way possible. This is giving them a caveat so that if, in fact, they do choose this option to do something less than the best method and it is unsuccessful, the fire burns onto someone else's place, then it's going to start a finger-pointing game where under current law there's no finger-point allowed. It's the Forestry Department's responsibility. And this, I think they're going to say, well, we did what the landowner asked us to do, and it didn't work. And the landowner's going to say, yeah, but you have the final authority to override that. So where this is a feel-good approach to use a softer technique on forest land, it gives me some concern because I think it does open a loophole of liability for the person who had nothing to say about the issue, but his trees got burned up, or his house got burned up. And I don't know. You know, I understand, I've heard the concerns, and it does still say the Forestry Department has a final say, that it seems to me like that should point the liability back to the Forestry Department. But at the same time, I'm concerned.
Mr. Chair, first of all, that number 3 does not relieve them of the standard of care that they have to exhibit in fighting fires. It just says they can listen to the owner, and if in their determination it still meets their standard, they can use it. But they make that decision. So the standard of care is exactly the same because of that last sentence that they have to make the judgment. It can be either meets that standard or doesn't. So I think the liability, as I said, no one can make absolute until it goes to this court, but just thinking how the law acts in general, the liability would be the same as it is now.
Yeah, I guess my point is, why do we need that sentence? Because I think under current law, the State Forest Department can use softer approaches if they don't think we need to go full blood, you know, aerosol tankers and retardant on the fire. They don't have to do that just because it's available. They already have the ability to make that determination. So why are we putting this language in the statute, which just seems to me open the door that could open, you know, that could start liability lawsuits, which isn't there currently.
So, Representative Byer, you'd be more comfortable without that whole section in there, is what you're saying.
Yeah, I don't think we need Section 3 of the Subsection 3 of the bill, because I think they have the authority to do that without consulting a property owner. Or if a property owner comes, if a fire is going on my property, and I say, look, you know, there's a little creek over there my kids like to play in. Let's just keep the cats out of it, can you? They don't need this law to keep the cats out of it now. They can do that. And I guess what they're trying to do is they're trying to put in a statute to give them the authority to do what they're currently doing. And if they're currently doing it and haven't been sued for it, then why would we open the door that now we can get sued because it's in the statute? I don't know. It seems to muddy up the statute to me.
We have a motion. I hate to wordsmith this thing to death.
Mr. Chair,
I think the judgment of the forester conditions warrant the use of alternatives. So, you know, they're making that decision.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I will vote for the bill, but I do not like subsection 3 of the bill.
Okay. I'm going to move ahead and on the motion and then call the roll. Yes.
Excuse me.
The boy is probably carrying the bill. I've been volunteering for quite a few last year, so I'm getting pretty lined up. That was work session on Senate Bill 226, and if there's anything else to come before the committee, we'll have Senate Bill 224 back as soon as we get the draft. They'll be adding the emergency clause and additional language, putting our marks on that bill, at least. And with that, thank you.
Very good.